Chapter 8 Seeking for a Path. Birendranath Mazumdar was summoned to Commandant Schmidt's office. There stood a young, smiling, dark-skinned Indian of medium height. Another Indian in Colditz was surprising enough, but what made the encounter even odder was his outfit. The man was dressed in the field-grey uniform of the German Wehrmacht. Only the badge was different, a leaping tiger set against the orange, white and green flag of the Indian National Congress, the organisation leading the struggle for independence from Britain. The young man spoke in English. "I bring a message from Subhas Chandra Bose. He wishes you to come to Berlin." Subhas Chandra Bose, Indian nationalist and Nazi collaborator, soldier and politician, was and remains one of the most controversial figures in 20th century history. In many Indian eyes, he was a patriotic freedom fighter. In most British ones, a traitor and a quisling. Bose's early life mirrored that of Mazumdar, 17 years his junior, the son of a wealthy Bengali family, educated in Britain. He was intellectual, cultured, charismatic, and fiercely opposed to British rule in India. He had risen to become president of the Indian National Congress, but unlike Mahatma Gandhi, Bose was ready to use violence to hasten independence. His followers called him Netaji, or revered leader. The British considered him a dangerous subversive, and in 1940 he was placed under house arrest in Calcutta. A year later, with the help of the Abwehr, he escaped disguised as an Afghan insurance salesman. German agents spirited him to Peshawar and across Afghanistan to the Soviet Union, where he assumed a new identity as an Italian nobleman, Count Orlando Mazzotta. From there, the Germans laid on a secret plane to bring him to Berlin. Once inside the Third Reich, with German backing, Bose set about recruiting his fellow Indians to fight against Britain. He founded the Free India Centre, set up a radio station broadcasting anti-British, pro-Axis propaganda to India, and formed the Free Indian Legion, also known as the Tiger Legion, an all-Indian infantry force of volunteers, made up of expatriates and POWs recruited from the camps. Its soldiers swore an oath of allegiance to both Adolf Hitler and Subhas Chandra Bose. By 1942, the Tiger Legion was 1,000 strong. Word quickly spread through Colditz that Mazumdar was being taken to meet the Indian quisling, raising an army to fight the British in the Far East. The other prisoners were scornful. "Goodbye, Jumbo. Have a good war in Burma." Most assumed that the Indian doctor had already switched sides, confirming their suspicions of disloyalty. "We never expected to see him again," said one. On the morning of his departure, Mazumdar was cleaning his teeth in the washrooms when someone remarked loudly, "That bloody Mazumdar is a spy. He's going to Berlin." The voice belonged to Captain Harry Elliott, one of the first British officers sent to Colditz. Mazumdar turned in a cold fury. "Harry, did I hear you say I'm a spy? I give you 5 minutes to withdraw this accusation." The two men squared up. Elliot was a guardsman, 6 feet 2 inches tall. He looked down at the Indian doctor, 5 feet 7 in his socks, and laughed. "My blood tingled from my feet to my head," Mazumdar later wrote. "I gave him such a hook, right on the jaw, and he fell flat." Astride Elliot's chest, punching him repeatedly, Mazumdar shouted, "I'll kill you. You don't know what I've gone through." He was dragged off by the other officers, panting and pale with rage, and brought before Colonel Stainer for assaulting a senior officer. "I told him the reason," said Mazumdar, "but he didn't believe me." On the 23rd of June, Mazumdar was taken to Berlin in a first-class train compartment. At the station, he was picked up in a chauffeur-driven Mercedes and driven to the Free India Centre on Liechtenstein Allee in the Tiergarten area of Berlin. A dozen well-dressed Indian men were smoking and talking in the lobby. To his astonishment, they greeted him by name. A minute later, he was shown into a large room. A balding, bespectacled figure wearing a civilian suit rose from behind the desk and extended a hand. An admirer of Bose since childhood, Mazumdar was suddenly starstruck dumb. In a soft, authoritative voice, Bose made his pitch. "Join my legion," he said. "Come and fight for the freedom of India, our motherland." When Mazumdar said nothing, he carried on. "I am an example of someone who has always struggled for my country's freedom. Join me." Mazumdar pointed out that he had pledged an oath of allegiance to the king. "I have given my word of honour and cannot go back on this." Bose smiled. "Let us have some lunch." Over a leisurely meal in Bose's private quarters, served by a waiter in white gloves, the Indian nationalist leader kept up the pressure. They spoke Bengali, occasionally slipping into English. Bose described meeting Hitler at the Reich Chancellery a few weeks earlier. The Führer had offered a German U-boat to take him to Bangkok, from where the Indian Revolution could be directed. "I am not in full agreement with the Nazi philosophy," Bose told Mazumdar, "and I candidly told them so, but I hope to gain India's independence through Nazi help." He said he had recruited hundreds of Indians from the British Indian Army, but as yet not one King's commissioned officer from the British Army. Mazumdar could be the first. "I have been fighting the British for the last 15 years, Bose said earnestly. "I know what it is like to be a prisoner, as you do, so I sympathise with your circumstances." They talked through the afternoon and long into the evening. Mazumdar was flattered that this great man should try to recruit him, but he was also insistent. "I am opposed to the British rule in India. I have seen the results, but I have sworn an oath of allegiance to Britain." At 2 a.m., the meeting finally broke up. "Think it over," said Bose as they parted. "We will meet again in the morning." Despite clean sheets and the most comfortable bed he had known for 2 years, Mazumdar slept little, torn by the choice he now faced. The opportunity to fight for Indian independence under a magnetic leader and win his freedom, not just from the confines of Colditz, but the racial prejudice that redoubled the misery of imprisonment, and, on the other hand, his vow of loyalty to Britain, his ingrained sense of duty, and his father's admonition that a gentleman's word is his bond. The next morning, Mazumdar sensed Bose was losing patience. "What is your decision?" Mazumdar replied that while he strongly sympathised with Bose's position and opposed the British, he was not ready to join the Tiger Legion. "The answer is no." Bose pressed a button on the desk and rose to his feet. "I have chosen my way and you have chosen yours. Goodbye and good luck." As Mazumdar left the room, Bose called out, "When you change your mind, we will be here." In contrast to his first-class outbound journey, Mazumdar returned in grimy third class. "There was no doubt in my mind that I had done the right thing," he reflected. "The other British officers must accept him now." But back in Colditz, he faced fresh mockery. "Didn't he want you after all?" they jeered. "Oh yes, he wanted me all right, and I would very much have liked to accept his offer to join him. He's such a wonderful man. But then I couldn't, could I?" "Why ever not?" "Because I hold a British commission, and I therefore owe my loyalty to the King, whatever my political views and private feelings might be." He explained what had happened to Colonel Stainer. "They asked me to join them and cooperate with the Germans. I told them I can't do it." The senior British officer seemed unimpressed. Look, Colonel, I'm going to escape one day, Mazumdar continued. Well, don't expect us to give you anything, maps or money. It's what I expected, sir, Mazumdar said quietly. You will hear from me. Mazumdar's decision to reject Bose's offer did not change the way he was seen by other officers. Instead, it widened the gulf. He had turned down an opportunity to escape, a prospect they spent their days and nights plotting and imagining. He merely had to say the word, and he could walk free at any time, because he was of a different race. Mazumdar was more alone than ever. No one shared his predicament. No other prisoner had made a choice to remain locked in Colditz. Most of the other prisoners were distant, and sometimes actively hostile. I was the sole Indian. It was impossible even to converse in my mother tongue. In ordinary times, this is no handicap, but prison life, with its restrictions and whatnot, makes it doubly so. Mazumdar sounded oddly English in his understatement. Only an Englishman would refer to the grim privations of Colditz as whatnot. At night, on a scratchy mattress in an uncomfortable bunk, he wrote poems in Bengali, searching for a way out of his dilemma. In the darkened light, the awakened soul, seeking for a path. Which direction to take? Disturbed, he starts to think what to do. He then realizes the need for a companion. The question is where to find one. They are so precious. At last, he pleads with the gods to find him one. Colditz was riddled with hiding places, where escape equipment and money could be securely hidden until needed. In wall cavities, under floorboards, in ceilings. The ferrets launched repeated raids in search of contraband and were often successful, recovering stockpiles of food, maps, money, files, compasses, pliers, batteries, drills, keys, screwdrivers, rope, fake uniforms, and counterfeit documents. Sometimes the work of concealment combined with goon baiting. Unteroffizier Schädlich, the indefatigable ferret, found that the floorboards in a corner of the British quarters had been neatly cut. He levered them up and found a piece of paper underneath with the words, Leck mich im Arsch, kiss my arse, the original name of Mozart's canon for six voices in B-flat major. Each successful search augmented the collection of confiscated escape artefacts in his Colditz museum, but Eggers was worried. Where were these things coming from? The X-ray machine was working efficiently, and every incoming parcel was carefully searched. The quantity of naughty packages seemed to have dwindled away, yet somehow objects, including tools of considerable size, such as hammers and a soldering iron, were still being smuggled in. Eggers blamed corrupt guards willing to trade cigarettes and Red Cross luxuries for banned items. An undercover civilian police inspector was introduced to the castle, disguised as a German corporal, to try to find the culprits. The whole charade turned out to be useless. The guard contingent was replaced, but the contraband was still getting through. Only years later did Eggers find out how. A half-Egyptian, Algerian-born French officer with a scar on his cheek from a sword slash, a red silk scarf around his neck, and an uncanny talent for burglary. Despite his villainous appearance, Lieutenant Frederic Scarface Gieg was a man of education who had studied engineering at the elite École des Arts et Métiers in Paris. He was the best lockpicker in Colditz. The system for receiving, guarding, and then distributing incoming packages followed a set pattern. The locked door to the parcels office from the courtyard was manned by a sentry, with two further internal doors, each locked. When parcels arrived, they were registered and kept in the office overnight, inspected and x-rayed the following day, and then allocated to the recipient in person. The only way to ensure the delivery of contraband was to get to a parcel before it was handed over, remove the hidden item, and replace it with an innocuous replica. This, in turn, required access to the parcel office without being detected, a task made even harder when the outer door was fitted with a cruciform lock, the latest development in German lock technology. Made by Zeiss Icon, the key was in the shape of a cross, with each groove on the four edges precision cut to 1/1000th of an inch and corresponding to a set of pins, which in turn rotated a circular drum to open the mortise bolt. The Germans believed it could not be picked, which was an enormous advantage, because it could. After months of experimentation, Gieg fashioned his own blank cruciform key using a spindle stolen from the mechanism of the tower clock. Next, during the distraction caused by a visiting German general, his team managed to extract the lock itself, measure the exact size of the grooves, and then reinstall it. Using a tiny saw made from a razor blade, Gieg carved the notches into his homemade cross key, which he hid inside a hollowed bedpost, concealed behind a knot made of cork. Getting into the parcels office required a team of 17 decoys, lookouts, and assistants to divert the sentry's attention just long enough for Gieg to enter and lock the door behind him. Picking the ancient lever locks on the internal doors was comparatively easy. The French could now order specific items in coded letters to friends and family in France and collect them at night before the parcels were opened. Two packages of tools weighing 5 kilograms apiece, cash, alcohol in 2-litre tins, paint, documents, and finally the parts for constructing 2 radios, powered by a small generator with a hand crank sealed up in a tin of ham. Whenever a new explosive parcel arrived, often containing tins marked sanglier en sauce, wild boar in sauce, Fredo Gieg would sneak in, remove the contraband, and defuse the package. Eggers never discovered how the prisoners were getting into the parcels depot, but his suspicions were sharply raised when, one morning, the prison cat was found on one side of the internal locked doors and her kittens on the other. A second cruciform lock was fitted on the inner door and an electric alarm system connected to the outer door. Astonishingly, during one of his nocturnal visits, Gieg managed to intercept the wiring and rig up an additional circuit with a switch in the floor above. The alarm could now be activated and deactivated as necessary. The French also suspected that someone else was breaking in and secretly inspecting the parcels. A German guard from Alsace-Lorraine, the disputed area of France annexed by Germany in 1940, had been observed hanging around the office late at night. As a German Alsatian, he was already a collaborator in French eyes. Gieg installed one of his men in the parcels office, a tough young officer named Yves Desmarchelier. Sure enough, the suspect guard entered and began rifling parcels. Sensing a movement behind him, he turned and saw the prisoner watching him from behind a pile of sacks. A desperate fight ensued. As Desmarchelier's hands closed around his throat, the soldier gasped in French, "Don't be a fool!" These were his last words. "He was a traitor," said Desmarchelier. The man's body was found the next morning, strung up from the rafters by a hangman's noose. Eggers was baffled. Why would this man have chosen to kill himself inside the parcels office? "We had no option but to assume suicide," he wrote. The French were willing to order and extract items for the other nations, and eventually the Dutch and British were inducted into the secret and the arcane art of cruciform lock picking. British burglary duties were in the supple hands of an ebullient 24-year-old Australian fighter pilot from Townsville, Queensland, named Bush Parker, an amateur magician and card sharp whose party trick was to place a matchstick on his sleeve, and when he let it go, it used to jump a couple of feet in the air. No one ever worked out how he did this. Parker claimed to be able to open any lock in the castle, using a set of homemade picks and a tube of toothpaste to hold the lock open when the tumblers lifted. Free access to the parcels office, wrote Pat Reed, was an inestimable boon. But in May 1942, a British officer almost destroyed the system. Frank Errol Flynn had recently been released from solitary. One morning, without warning and in full view of the courtyard, he rushed up to the outer door of the parcels office and began trying to pick it, completely ineffectively and with considerable violence, using a wire hook. The German sentries did not immediately spot him, but Gieg did, in horror. If the Germans thought the lock was vulnerable or damaged, they would change it, and the arduous process of making another key would have to start again from scratch. The Englishman was strong as a devil, but undergoing some sort of psychological crisis, wrote Gieg. He signalled to an accomplice on the first floor of the French quarters to activate the alarm. Seconds later, wrote Reed, a squad of goons rushed into the courtyard and carried Flynn off, to begin yet another stint in the cells. At first, some of the Germans believed Flynn's erratic behaviour was contrived. He pretends to be mental, wrote Schädlich in his diary. Colonel Steiner is doing his best to make us believe that this illness is genuine. But Reed was convinced that this was no act. Sadly, by this time, Flynn was going round the bend. The most solitary man in Colditz was becoming a liability. Michael Sinclair arrived in Colditz in March 1942 with a plan already formulated that would grow into an obsession. To get to Poland, reunite with the formidable British woman resistance fighter he had come to see as a surrogate mother, and then, with her help, to get away. A year earlier, three bedraggled and exhausted British soldiers knocked on the door of an innocuous two-roomed apartment on Kmielna Street in Warsaw. The trio had escaped from the prison camp in Poznan in central Poland by hiding in a handcart filled with rubbish. They had planned to cross the frontier into Russia, but the declaration of war between Germany and the Soviet Union rendered this impossible. So instead, they had walked back to Warsaw, passed from one resistance cell to another, until, like so many other British escapers, they wound up at the Kmielna Street apartment. The leader of the fugitive band was Sinclair, a red-haired 23-year-old lieutenant in the 60th King's Royal Rifles. Until the retreat from Dunkirk, Sinclair's life had followed exactly the pattern that he, and everyone else, expected of it. The son of an army officer, he had played cricket for Winchester at Lord's, acted in every school play, studied languages at Cambridge with distinction, won a golf blue, prayed hard in church every Sunday, and joined his father's regiment. But then he had been captured, and Sinclair's vision of his own destiny had suddenly fallen apart. Out of uniform, without the structure of family, regiment, and religion, Sinclair had no idea who he was. His need to escape was not simply urgent and all-consuming, but pathological. For Mike Sinclair, there was God, then the 60th, and that was it. His only aim in life was to get back to his regiment. The door was opened by Mrs. Janina Markovska, who ushered them into her back room where an excellent lunch had been laid on, the first decent food they had eaten for a month. Mrs. Markovska lived with a husband 20 years her senior, a retired Polish civil servant she referred to with ill-disguised contempt as Daddy. Like so many Warsaw residents, she spent her days scavenging for what little food could be found in shops or on the black market. In one of the unpredictable roundups that were a feature of daily life under Nazi occupation, she had been taken in for questioning before being released as a harmless old lady. Mrs. Markowska might have been a perfectly ordinary Polish housewife, except that she spoke English with a strong Scottish accent. Mrs. Markowska was really Jane Walker, an agent of British intelligence, a senior figure in the Polish underground army, and the coordinator of the Anglo-Polish Society, a secret resistance network sheltering escaped British POWs and smuggling them to safety. Jane Walker was born in Dalmeny, west of Edinburgh, in 1874. As a teenager, she moved with her family to Berlin, where her father was appointed military attaché at the British Embassy. Intelligent and restless, she drifted into the world of intelligence, becoming a King's Messenger, a Foreign Office courier carrying secret communications. Before the First World War, she conveyed dozens of messages on behalf of the British government between Germany and Switzerland. Speaking fluent German, French, and Polish, she worked for a time in Vienna as governess to a branch of the Habsburg royal family. In 1920, she married, settled in Warsaw, and became, to all outward appearances, wholly Polish. But as one escaping POW put it, she remained British to the core, a great patriot of the old-fashioned kind, breathing with her every breath fire, slaughter, and defiance of Britain's enemies. She was tyrannical, obstinate, and intolerant. She was also capable of great affection, sympathy, and unselfishness. Her apartment was a haven for fugitive British soldiers, whom she then farmed out to safe houses around the city, moving them every few days. This feat of logistics was achieved in coordination with the Polish underground state, the political and military organization of the Polish resistance. Unlike other occupied countries, Poland never formally surrendered. While the Polish government in exile established its headquarters in London, the parallel underground state was formed in Poland itself, with a secret parliament, executive, judiciary, and army, and even an education department, a propaganda wing, and social services. Between September 1940 and May 1942, the Anglo-Polish Society Escape Network took in 65 British servicemen on the run and managed to smuggle 52 of them to safety, on ships to neutral Sweden, through the Balkans to neutral Turkey, via Hungary, Romania, or Yugoslavia, or into Germany and then out again through Switzerland. Intense and overbearing, Mrs. Markowska treated her Tommies with stern fondness, as the children she had never had, providing food, shelter, patriotic pep talks, and even medical attention from a doctor prepared to risk treating escaped prisoners. She liked to lay on more or less formal dinners for her guests, with numerous toasts to the British royal family. The POWs feared, revered, and adored her. "In dark and dangerous days," wrote one escaper, "we loved her. They called her Mrs. M." Jane Walker's escape network was funded by selling ladies' stockings on the Warsaw black market, while the Polish resistance furnished false papers, additional money, and guides. The work was spectacularly dangerous. The Gestapo knew an underground escape route for Allied soldiers was in operation and devoted considerable efforts to destroying it. The average life expectancy of a courier for the secret state was just a few months. Mrs. M knew that if caught by the Gestapo, she would be tortured and executed, and she treated that knowledge with sublime insouciance. Whenever she was asked why she remained in Poland rather than return to the safety of her native land, she would fix the questioner with a shriveling look and a statement of what was, to Mrs. M, patently obvious. A British woman does not like to run away. Michael Sinclair and his two companions were now under the care of this particularly ferocious mother hen. Thus began our strange sojourn in Poland's capital, temporary guests of those many brave and generous people who willingly accepted all the risk involved to help us on our way. Mrs. M was to become a mother to us. Getting the soldiers home would be difficult, she warned, but Mrs. M promised to find a way. We have contacts with underground organisations, official and unofficial, she said. The fugitives were split up and billeted among the members of Mrs. M's network. Sinclair struck up an immediate rapport with the Polish family who took him in, moved by their friendship, hospitality, and staggering bravery. One safe house was near the Jewish ghetto, and at night the rattle of machine guns could be heard as the SS went about its genocidal work. One evening, Sinclair listened to the BBC on Mrs. M's illegal wireless and heard a message of encouragement and hope. Every day he remained in Warsaw, Sinclair's loathing for the Nazis increased, along with his admiration for the Polish resistance and the Scotswoman determined to fight them. By late summer, Mrs. M had a plan. You will go by train to Krakow, where a guide will meet you and take you through the mountains to Slovakia. Then you will be driven south by car to the Hungarian border. You will take the train to Budapest, where you will be met by friends. These would then arrange safe onward passage through Yugoslavia and Bulgaria to neutral Turkey, where they could contact the British Embassy. At the end of August 1941, after a fond farewell to Mrs. M, Sinclair set off, accompanied by Ronnie Littledale, with whom he had escaped from Poznan. Her prediction that this would be a long and intricate journey proved an understatement. After a grueling slog by rail and on foot, they finally arrived in Budapest in October. A month later, furnished with false papers by the anti-Nazi resistance, they boarded a train to Belgrade, and on the 16th of November, Sinclair and Littledale reached the Bulgarian frontier. Then disaster struck. An observant border official spotted a mistake in their fake Yugoslav papers. They were arrested, handed over to the German police in Sofia, shipped to Vienna, and brutally interrogated by the Gestapo. After 2 months in a military prison, the two men were hauled out and loaded onto a train for Dresden under armed guard. Somewhere on the outskirts of Prague, Sinclair squeezed through a lavatory window and threw himself out of the moving train. He had hobbled only a few hundred yards on a twisted ankle before he was recaptured and sent to Colditz. Sinclair's arrival injected new energy into the escapers' community. His single-minded pursuit of liberty came tinged with bloodlust. Freedom offered the possibility of vengeance, an opportunity to continue the fight not just for king and country, but for Mrs. M and her Polish network. He seemed to be on a personal crusade between himself and the whole of Hitler's occupied Europe, said Pat Reed, who was impressed and slightly awed by Sinclair's unwavering resolve. Even Frank Flynn, the record holder for time spent in solitary confinement, seemed tame by comparison in his determination to get out of Colditz. Sinclair spent hours staring furiously over the castle ramparts, smoking his pipe, dreaming of escape, monitoring and memorizing the guards' movements, rehearsing details, searching for gaps in the walls around him. An opportunity came just a few weeks after his arrival. In June, he was sent to Leipzig for a sinus operation. He climbed out of a hospital window and got as far as Cologne, where, by sheer misfortune, an intensive manhunt was underway for an RAF bombing crew who had parachuted into nearby woods after their plane was shot down. Sinclair was captured and taken to a nearby camp. He promptly escaped and was just as swiftly recaptured and bundled back inside Colditz to resume his vigil at the window. Poor Mike absolutely loathed every minute of this life and had no other interest except in trying to escape, wrote a fellow inmate. He would never admit defeat. The kaleidoscope of the Colditz population changed continually, with new arrivals and departures. The POW administration was unpredictable in its decisions. The prisoners never knew when they might be moved to another camp or why, creating another layer of uncertainty. Two-thirds of the Polish contingent were removed in May, leaving behind some 40 officers, mostly hardened escaper types, in Reed's estimation. 31 of the French officers, including many of the Jews, were marched off to another camp at Lübeck, and others were brought in. The British population gradually expanded with the addition of officers who had tried to escape from other camps. As they were marched in, the new inmates were greeted with loud cheering from the windows, and sometimes a hail of water bombs. One of the nastier traditions of the British public school was the ritual humiliation of new bugs by older boys. This too had its counterpart in Colditz. Pat Reed described the reception given to 16 naval officers from Lambsdorff. On their first day in Colditz, the new arrivals were summoned to a bogus medical examination in the British quarters, where an officer dressed in fake German uniform and posing as the camp doctor, complete with stethoscope, ordered them to drop their trousers before loudly declaring in German that they were all infested with venereal crabs. A medical assistant in a lab coat, barely able to contain his mirth, then daubed their testicles with a blue woad made up of scenery paint and high-smelling lavatory disinfectant. Reed described this incident as having fun at the new boy's expense, but it was straightforward bullying, a brutal assertion of power of the sort that English public schoolboys have always inflicted on one another. In July, Oberstleutnant Schmidt reached the age of 70 and retired, to be replaced by a commandant of a different stamp. Oberst, or Colonel, Edgar Gleischer, was very much a new broom, wrote Eggers. Punctilious in observing the Geneva Convention, but a strict disciplinarian fresh from the Eastern Front, Gleischer came determined to make a clean sweep, as new brooms tend to. He demanded and expected respect, and got nothing of the sort. The new commandant had a squint. Inevitably, the rowdier prisoners crossed their eyes whenever he appeared. The halo of his authority was quite simply ignored, noted Eggers. He had no idea of what he was letting himself in for. Escape attempts continued at a rate of almost two a week through July and August, some promising, some wild, and almost all fruitless. The punctuation marks of life in captivity. Whenever anyone vanished, there was a slow rising of hope as the hours and days passed, to be dashed when the escaper was brought back. One Englishman jumped over the wall of the exercise yard beside the town cells and reached Chemnitz on a stolen bicycle before he was apprehended. Buoyed by Mike Sinclair's account of Mrs. M's Anglo-Polish escape network, some resolved to try to get to Poland rather than attempt the Swiss border crossing. The Dutch and British both tried to break into the main sewer, but were caught in the act. A half-built Polish tunnel was discovered, containing tools and a homemade typewriter. A Frenchman tried to walk out of the park disguised as a painter. Among the new regulations imposed by Commandant Gleischer was a limit on personal property. Guards arrived with boxes to remove surplus items into storage. RAF officer Dominic Bruce, one of the smaller prisoners in Colditz, was packed into a Canadian Red Cross tea chest labelled Surplus Items, equipped with a 40-foot bedsheet rope and knife. He was loaded onto a lorry with the rest of the excess luggage and carried to a third-floor room in the German Kommandantur. That night he emerged, climbed through a window, and descended the wall into the moat, leaving behind a note in German inside the empty box. The air in Colditz no longer agrees with me. Goodbye. He stole a bicycle and got as far as the port of Danzig, where he was intercepted before he could stow away on a ship. That summer, the British recorded just one victory. In June, RAF officer Brian Padden was transferred from Colditz to the camp at Thorn, where he was due to face a court-martial for insulting a guard. He joined a work party headed to the fields, hid behind a haystack, and then made his way to the Baltic coast and stowed away in the coal hold of a Swedish merchant vessel. Once the ship set sail, he persuaded the captain to take him to Gävle, 100 miles north of Stockholm, where the British consul arranged for him to fly back to the UK. Padden's escape was exceptional, an important morale booster when news filtered back to Colditz, but it had started when he was already far beyond the prison walls. Commandant Glacier's raft of new security measures included roll calls in the middle of the night, body searches, a new system of passwords, and sudden, unexpected raids in search of contraband. Books, papers, toilet requisites, cupboards, tables, chairs and stools upturned, beds shifted, bedding removed, floorboards torn up. The new commandant reduced the alcohol intake in the German mess, installed a new alarm system with tripwires in the park, and ordered the construction of wire mesh catwalks and a wooden watchtower, 12 metres high, from which the sentries could survey the terraces. A machine gun emplacement was installed overlooking the inner courtyard, and a photographer to monitor and record what was taking place below. Nearly every hour, guard parties are patrolling the castle or carrying out checks, noted Schädlich. The prisoners were constantly watched, while continually watching their jailers. The system of stooging never let up. The men stood at windows, apparently reading or casually smoking, while discreetly observing what was going on below and passing a signal if the Germans appeared, a hat removed, a book closed. The moment our search parties got anywhere near, their excellent warning systems took over, and all we were met with was a dirty grin on the faces of the POWs, wrote Gebhardt. The unrelenting mutual surveillance, the searches, the ebb and flow of hope and despondency created a unique atmosphere, a tension that increasingly erupted into near rioting, horseplay that swiftly got out of hand. In June, a fire was deliberately started at the bottom of the British staircase. It was quickly extinguished, but the acrid stench lingered in the stairwell and corridors for days. How empty of amusement life must be for grown men to welcome fire as a diversion, Padre Platt reflected. A water fight in the hot courtyard reached such ferocity that the riot squad was summoned. The German officer in command was met with a chorus of barracking from the windows. A soldier pulled his trigger and the bullet ricocheted into the neck of a French lieutenant watching from a window. He recovered, but with a paralysed left hand. A few weeks later, Glacier ordered a roll call for the French alone as a punishment at 1 a.m. and then another half an hour later. The other nations stood at the windows, baying their disrespect. This took the form of loud animal and bird noises, a cockerel here, a cow there, mixed with wailing sirens. The uproar grew steadily louder. The guards lined up, rifles aimed at the upper floors. Suddenly they opened fire and a volley of bullets smashed into the window panes. Eggers later claimed the order to fire had been accidental. No one was hurt, but friction was growing. Indiscipline, almost mutiny, could be felt everywhere, wrote Eggers. But then, occasionally, just as suddenly, the anger seemed to dissipate. Sometimes the resistance collapsed, observed Giles Romilly, the prisoner singled out for special treatment. There were periods when the old looked old. The young did not look fit, and the ardours of defiance, never an unforced growth, failed to leap out. the Germans would find that they had quiet parades and would patter secure along our files, almost like nannies. There was desperation beneath the confrontational hilarity. Sometimes the mental pressure was visible and dramatic, as with Frank Flynn. More frequently, it was hidden. A Canadian airman, among the first inmates to enter Colditz, became obsessed with releasing his wife from their marriage and tried to cut his wrists. During roll call, he went demonstrably off his rocker, a friend recalled, crying and pleading with the guards to shoot him. Finally, he slit his throat with a broken bottle and was removed to a psychiatric hospital. In a mark of how deep the sexual frustration ran, another officer tried to castrate himself. Most wore their sadness in secrecy or vigorously repressed it. "I suddenly realised I was going round the bend," wrote one officer. "I took myself, metaphorically, off into the corner of the room and gave myself a good dressing down." But even the most optimistic felt their spirits start to sag as the months passed. Pat Reed stood down as escape officer. He needed to imagine the possibility of liberty again.